This season is supported by Portercus. Welcome to Behind the Pages, the podcast of the Journal on Education in Emergencies, or JEIE. I'm your host, Nathan Thompson. JEIE is a peer-reviewed publication established by the Interagency Network for Education in Emergencies and housed at New York University. JEIE publishes groundbreaking scholarly and practitioner work on education in countries and regions affected by crisis, conflict, and environmental disaster. JEIE provides rigorous open access evidence to inform programming, policymaking, funding, and future research. Join us as we speak with authors from our recent special issue on education in pandemics about the effects the pandemic has had on students, parents, and teachers, and as we discuss the lessons for future health emergencies informed by innovative responses to COVID-19 school closures. In September 2019, the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo eliminated fees for public primary schools. The policy enabled an additional 3 million students to enroll in primary school almost immediately. This massive influx of students into Congolese schools was complicated by the viral spread of COVID in the country, which closed schools for over 4 months beginning in March 2020. Today we'll hear from two authors featured in our recent special issue on education and pandemics. Their work, considered together, suggests that to create the kind of resilient education systems that can withstand shocks like COVID and a massive increase in student enrollment, there must be a sustained focus on the economic and financial conditions of teachers, and on parents' and caregivers' capacity to be confident, effective at-home educators, especially for the sake of students with disabilities. Jean-Benoît Felice is a senior lecturer at the University of Edinburgh School of Social and Political Science. His research focuses on access and provision of social services, including healthcare, education, and justice, with an emphasis on mixed methods research, including the use of interviews, archival work, surveys, and field experiments. Sue Corcoran is a research associate at Manchester Metropolitan University's Education and Social Research Institute, and a consultant with the Enabling Education Network. Her research interests center on inclusive education and social justice, including street-connected youth's education experiences, inclusive pedagogy, disability, gender, and forced displacement. Jean-Benoît, Sue, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here today.
Hi, Nathan. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you. So one of the reasons we wanted to bring you both together in conversation on this episode is that your articles both report on the educational experience in the Congo during COVID. And of course, Sue, your article also highlights the Syrian context as well, which I'll ask you about specifically a little later on. But could you both help set the stage in terms of the context in Congo before COVID hit, and what was the response to COVID like?
So to understand the situation before 2019, you have to think about, I think, a series of parallel crises. You have a learning crisis that's very clear. All the data shows that kids are not learning as much as they should or as much as they could. This is due to a wide range of factors, but that includes teachers' training, teachers' ability, infrastructure, but also simply access to schools. And that's because of another crisis, which is the funding crisis that started in the late 80s when the state was unable to fund schools and invited, to put it mildly, parents to contribute to the budget of schools. And very quickly, by the 90s, parents became almost the sole contributors to the budget of schools, and that includes paying teachers. It improved a bit in the next decade, but still by 2017 you had households contributing about 150% more than the state to school budget. So really a big funding crisis. The one sort of glimmer of hope, if you want, in that context is about school enrollment. That did increase substantially over the past 20 years, with more kids going to school and for longer. But still, big questions about what they're actually learning and the sustainability of the model.
So I want to get into specifics of the research that you each wrote. Sue, you wrote the research article, Home Learning for Children in Low-Income Contexts During a Pandemic, an analysis of 2020 survey results from Syria and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, with Helen Pinnock and Rachel Twigg. What did you learn about the availability of materials and infrastructure and guidance for parents and caregivers to support learning at home?
Okay, well, a little bit of wider context first before I focus in on the DRC. We've been working mainly in Zambia and Zanzibar, but also extending now over the last 3 years out to other countries across East and Central Africa, focusing on teacher education for inclusion. Or inclusive education, teacher training, MSA, and as well as training with organisations for people with disabilities. In 2020, because of COVID-19 arriving, it meant that a lot of the projects that we had planned for that year couldn't happen in the way that they were planned. And as we watched what was happening in terms of lots of countries going towards home learning, children with disabilities not really being considered in the discourses and the advice coming out from governments and the home learning resources that were there. There was lots of resources suddenly came online, but nobody was talking about low-income contexts where people don't have access to televisions and the internet, and very few people were talking about children with disabilities. And so we wanted to look at trying to develop a really easily accessible resource that we could put in the hands of parents to kind of take them back to basics of what could they do at home to improve children's learning, focusing mainly at the primary school age group and particularly on children with disabilities. And we put out a very small survey in 14 languages online, asking people to comment about the situation in their countries. We also carried out a follow-up survey, which was a telephone survey to parents and head teachers in Zambia and Zanzibar. And the paper that we've published in this special issue actually is just focuses on two of the 27 countries that actually we have responses for. They were the second and the third largest groups of respondents that we had, focusing on across the whole of the DRC, and also the ones from Syria. It's basically just for the participants all came from the autonomous region of North and East Syria. So those two kind of contexts. What we did was we used the results of the two surveys that we did to then inform what needed to go into a resource. And the resource is in kind of like multiple parts. The main bit is a poster that on one side has a nice, easily accessible, attractive picture that shows various different situations happening in a home context, such as playing with different bottles and just various little bits in water. There's one of parents singing with their children. There's another of building something with cardboard boxes. There's a storytelling situation with a grandparent. But they're all very simple things that happen at home, but stressing how learning can happen within that kind of context. So that's the first resource, and they're all available online on our website. And we have them now in 9 languages, I think it is, accessible. So that's the first resource. Alongside that is a booklet full of activities that can be done around the home that have specific focusing on different learning tasks. They're very useful during the pandemic just to kind of change parents' attitude towards being teachers, as it were. Because suddenly you have all of these parents, especially parents who haven't been educated themselves, suddenly expected to support their children's home learning. And that's one of the key things about the resources, just trying to engage with them and develop their confidence as teachers and showing just how rethinking a certain situation can actually help them to create a learning environment within their home.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's wonderful context. And I really appreciated how the focus is on building parents' confidence and also using materials that might be readily available at home. Jean-Benoit, your research article is titled Implementing Free Primary Education in a Crisis Context, COVID-19 and Education Reform in South Kivu, Democratic Republic of the Congo. You co-authored it with Cyril Brandt, Jean Mutengeri Basenji, Sweta Gupta, Diwadune Kenyehera, Pierre Marion, Pacifique Nanyagazaba, Ibrahim Safari, Gauthier Marchais, and Samuel Matabashi. Your team set out to investigate how COVID influenced the rollout of the September 2019 policy that abolished school fees for public primary schools. So I understand that we have a clip from Samuel Matabashi about the on-the-ground realities of free education in Congo. Jean-Benoit, can you set that up for us?
Yeah, so what I'm going to play is just a quick clip from my colleague, Samuel Matabishi, who is really the Congolese lead for this research. As you said, it's a big team, and it's always been a big effort. It's part of a big project called Breeze, and just one of the different outputs of that project. And the idea of the project was also to bring researchers from the Global North with researchers from the Global South. Unfortunately, most of the team speaks French, so it's a bit hard for them to be on this podcast. But I really wanted to play this little clip recorded by Professor Matabishi. So here we go.
Gratuité de l'enseignement primaire est l'un des objectifs phares du gouvernement congolais depuis septembre 2019.
It's about the difficulty of that kind of research, that kind of applied research, going to the field. So we did our research in the areas of Fizi and Uvira. Those are really, really tense. A lot of violence, armed groups, but also communal violence. Researchers that can be seen as a threat, can be seen as somebody a bit suspicious. It takes time to do that kind of research, and it takes a lot of caution. And you did already mention there was a massive increase in the number of students going to school, but the downside really was that you had a massive increase in the number of students per class without any change in the infrastructure. So classes often kind of double sizes. New students were coming in, but fees were abolished. There was a lot less money coming to school. So a lot of the infrastructure projects were abandoned. So schools stopped building new classes, new infrastructure. But also the general situation meant that it became harder for a lot of students to learn. And so anecdotally, we see reports of more students failing and stopping with their education, and potentially in the areas where we did our work, becoming the targets of armed groups that are always really eager to prey on any form of vulnerability. So that's, if you want, the really complex and messy release situation where you have both the rollout of this free education policy that's not fully funded or not properly funded, and at the same time COVID hitting some of the issues that were already mentioned earlier, but as in many countries around the world, you see a lot of students simply stopping their education, at least temporarily.
Well, thank you for sharing that clip, Jean-Benoit, and the additional learner context. I want to bring in some pieces from your research here as well. Can you explain the various conditions that the teachers in the country were working under and being paid under, and how COVID changed that dynamic?
Yeah, absolutely. It is really complicated. So I'll try and sum it up, but please take a look at the article if you want to understand the details of it. Essentially, before the free education policy, you had many different types of statuses, if you want, for teachers. So some were fully paid by the state and fully recognized, so official teachers, if you want. But actually a sizable proportion of teachers were either recognized by the state but not paid by the state. And some teachers were not even recognized by the state and not paid at all by the state, of course. Which means that it's parents and communities who are funding a lot of the teaching workforce, either directly, as you know, the entirety of the salary would come from parents paying all types of fees, or partially, because even if you are a fully paid teacher, the salaries were so low that they would often feel the need to be kind of topped up by parents' contributions. Then the free education policy effectively abolishes any type of fee paid by parents. But at the same time, it doesn't really provide school with an alternative for topping up salaries or paying the entirety of some of the salaries. Very quickly, what's happening is that schools are faced with a really difficult situation where part of the workforce is not paid anymore, and there's no way for them to legally pay them. The situation of the better off categories, so the ones who were already paid by the states and were officially recognized, that situation, I must say, is improving because their salaries are being raised by the states. But for the rest of the teachers, there really isn't much. There is for them the possibility to be included as official teachers, but in practice we see this is really, really hard. And if you don't have the right connections, if you don't belong to the right groups, you're simply not going to be able to join the group of the official teachers, if you want. So access to the teaching profession has always been a relatively complex story in the DSC and has often required a lot of connections, and it's obviously not changing with the free education policy reform.
Well, thank you for that, Jean-Benoit. This gives me a good segue to ask about the fact that both of your articles discuss in some sense how decentralization and the power of the state, or rather the limited power of the state, sort of affected the ability, its ability to provide direction or guidance for teachers and communities when schools closed. And you both mentioned that parents and teachers, many members of the community, mentioned confusion or mistrust of remote learning because of the lack of clear information or authority on the subject. What did your survey respondents tell you, Sue, about how they perceived home learning or remote learning?
In general, most of the respondents said that they couldn't access the home learning. There were respondents who talked about how centrally, for example, the Ministry of Education was talking about the fact that provision was being rolled out through the television, through the internet, and there was even hard copies of resources made available. However, at local levels, nobody knew about these hard copy resources, nobody had seen them. And most of the conversation was about the fact that a lot of people couldn't actually access the television. They didn't have the money to pay for the channel fees, they didn't have televisions, even a number of communities didn't have the radios needed to be able to access the program. So it was a case of feeling like there wasn't any access to home learning. And because of the decentralization and the fact that teachers weren't being paid in the areas where the respondents were telling us about what was happening, there was no local provision from teachers supporting the learners that they know of in the local area in that sense.
Yeah, if I may add to this, I mean, it's very similar to what we found, and it's not hard to see why. I mean, in our survey with parents, I think we surveyed about 700 parents. Only 33% had a radio. 20% had books at home. 40% of mothers and a quarter of fathers could not read or write. If you talk about television, I think the rate was 18%. So really, with those parameters, it's really hard to expect much from these supposedly big, top-down solutions. And we did see a few teachers trying to do some work, mostly trying to teach kids around them, but it's very anecdotal. It's really limited to those teachers who were better off, and they don't need to find a job to eat. And it's really a handful of cases. So in our survey, most kids did not have any form of schooling during the 4 months and a half of the first lockdown.
A couple of our participants talked about how some people were accessing tutors. They were paying for tutors during the lockdowns, so that those that have, for example, can access much more than those that don't have. So those inequalities of access were really defined and made much greater by school closures and just the lack of provision at local areas.
Great. And Sue, maybe we take this opportunity now to contrast the other study site that you write about in this article, which is the Syrian context. You know, it offers a number of kind of interesting contrasts with the situation in Congo. In reading your piece, the fact that international NGOs and mutual aid networks were so much more present in the region stood out to me. What was the role of those mutual aid networks and those INGOs in providing access to home learning? And actually, if you want to bring in now the home learning for children with disabilities, because I know they had a bit better reach in Syria.
Yeah, so one of the main differences between the DRC data that came in and the Syria data was that most of the people in the DRC had no links to, or they said they didn't have any links to young people with disabilities, but also they had no knowledge of any extra provision that was made. And those that did were saying that the centralized provision of home learning support, the television programs, etc., they weren't considering people with disabilities. There was no adaptations. For example, there was no sign language being used, and ways in which people with disabilities could access that learning provision. Syria gave a very different picture, but the main difference between Syria and DRC in terms of who was participating, the DRC survey talks about the whole of the country, whereas the Syria survey focuses straight in on all of our respondents came from the autonomous region of North and Eastern Syria. That particular region already has autonomy in terms of how they deliver education. And just because of the nature of the conflict in that area, or their experiences within the ongoing Syrian conflict, there are a large number of INGOs present in the area who have been delivering education, particularly focused on education for young people with disabilities. So there are a number of NGO-funded education centres that were already there. Because of the presence of those NGOs, but also the schools in the area have, prior to COVID, there were some very good community networks already set up around the centres, around the schools. So parents were connected to the schools, particularly parents of children with disabilities. And so because those communication aspects were already set up before COVID hit, within the context of lockdowns, it meant that they already had really well-established processes with which to keep that communication going. It also meant that they could use more informal methods to continue the home learning practice. So using WhatsApp, for example, whereas in the DRC, the teachers were kind of left to their own devices, the teachers in this area of Syria were actually provided training on how to create short videos that they could send out to their students on WhatsApp, for example, which meant that when the young people were trying to access the centralized support provided by the government, the TV programs, etc., the teachers could provide short videos that went alongside them to enable the students to access the learning better. They could provide more sign language based resources, for example, but also they started networks of parents so that parents would help each other. So parents could share resources, could share pictures, could share advice. And that meant that when the funding actually fell through for one of the centres 4 months into the lockdowns, and suddenly their provision wasn't there anymore, the parents could continue to support each other and keep going. So there was much more of an inclusive community set up.
Yep. Thank you for sharing that, Sue. I want to discuss some of the policy implications of your articles. Now, Jean-Benoit, reflecting on the rollout of the free primary education policy, are there other policies or approaches that the government should maybe have considered implementing in parallel that would have supported teachers better, or what other policies maybe should have been in place prior to the rollout of the free education policy that would have supported it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. It's a complicated question. I mean, if you look at the rollout of the free education policy, it does have a positive impact, right? You do see enrollment shooting up substantially so, and you see that during the pandemic period, which is quite remarkable. In most countries, enrollment is going down. So it does have positive effects, but then you also have aspects where clearly the effects, the combined effects of the rollout of the free education policy and COVID is leading to, for instance, worse learning outcomes, a crisis in terms of teachers' retention and things like that. So I think you need to, I mean, it's going to be very basic, but if you want to roll out that sort of policy, you need to fund it appropriately, right? It seems very, very basic, but I'm not sure that the funding really was in place for that in the DSC. And then you have to probably think about what is the situation that we have on the ground. And the situation we had on the ground with schools that were not left for themselves totally, but in great part had learned to kind of cope with the situation for about 25 years, probably more actually, 25 years is being a conservative here, probably more like 30 or 40 years really. So those schools had developed their own mechanism for coping, including hiring local teachers using their own money and thinking about their own strategies. And I think the problem of the free education policy is that it just discarded all of that or didn't pay any attention to all of that. And said, well, the problem is that parents are paying too much for for kids to go to school. This is true. This was a big barrier and still is, because, by the way, not all fees have totally vanished overnight. But the problem was and still is much more than that. So certainly thinking about how to better integrate this sort of de facto decentralized management of schools seems to me a key area for a better policy space.
And Sue, what policy initiatives do your findings suggest are needed to support caregivers and parents' capacities to be supportive at-home educators?
One of our policy findings in our survey focused on actually better resourcing teachers. But when I'm saying better resourcing teachers, it's not just about giving them resources, it's also being able to give them autonomy. Because what we find that where teachers have more autonomy and where they're able to adapt within the context that they understand, they're better able to respond to a certain situation, which plays into the findings from Jean-Benoit's study. And we think about, we have all of the teachers who have been considered illegal, but have been working in their context for such a long time that they understand their context better, possibly could be better able to adapt to the situations and can keep that learning moving forward if they're resourced in a way to do so. Although obviously in this context, it does mean financial resources as well, because we do want teachers to be paid. And that's one of the sad things about being in an area where we're relying on parents to pay for teachers. And this isn't just in the DRC, it's also when we look at low-cost community-based schools in places like Kenya and Uganda, that as soon as you have lockdowns that are created by a pandemic, then you suddenly have teachers who aren't being paid, and therefore they need to go elsewhere to try and feed their families. So they can't possibly support the learners that they would otherwise want to support. So in terms of the policy implications for me around that, it's mainly around resourcing teachers, but also preparing better networks. So what we found in Syria about where the local networks exist, they were much better able to support parents and move parents towards home learning. That was also seen in Kenya, Chile and Zanzibar in the survey details there. And it actually also feeds into research done in lots of different countries about inclusive education, that it's not just about what happens within a school, but it's also what happens between schools and beyond schools. It's about how schools build inclusive communities around them, how they work with parents, how they work with the local community. And, you know, that's from research, that's a really key part of setting up an inclusive education system, inclusive community. Where those are set up and where those are effective, they've been very good in enabling home learning to take place during the pandemic. And how do we bring parents into the learning within schools? So a major part of our policy advice would be about, you know, thinking of parents as resources, thinking of teachers as community resources, and developing those networks, and developing those communities and those partnerships, because those homeschool continuums are key regardless of whether we're in a lockdown and schools are closed or not. And they do improve children's performance and attainment in schools.
Sue, I think those are really great takeaways and reminders. Thank you for sharing those. And I want to leave it at that. And I want to thank you for being here today with me, and I've really enjoyed our discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nathan.
You can download the article we discussed today and listen to other segments of Behind the Pages at inee.org/podcasts, or subscribe to Behind the Pages wherever you get your podcasts. Our podcast is produced by Gabrielle Galanek. I'm your host, Nathan Thompson. Thanks for listening.